Good morning, world. Diners, travelers, unite. Here we are on the menu in one of our favorite places, Charleston, South Carolina. And who do we have up first? We did ourselves swell with the eating on this trip, Rabbit.
Well, there's just a great dining scene, and one has to struggle hard to keep up with it. It's such a difficult...
And it keeps getting better.
It's such a difficult job that we have keeping up. It's just a terrible chore to have to go there regularly. It really is such a charming, historical city, but with a very modern dining scene, that's a whole lot of fun.
And also, let's not forget the great shopping.
Oh, yeah, yes, that too.
But
this is not a show about shopping. This is a show about food, wine, and travel and things
lifestyle.
Like that.
And lifestyle? What's lifestyle
okay, so
without
shoes? So shoes are a lifestyle. Well, Mrs. Haig dented on the menu's credit card just slightly, but this time she didn't buy any shoes. She just bought dresses and things like that. But at the modern end of what's going on in Charleston, it was a chef that we met the last time we were there. We heard about it the last time we were there.
We didn't meet him.
No, everybody's. We did go by his restaurant, and he wasn't there. But
his staff raved about him,
and other people raved about him, and they said he's doing molecular gastronomy. So, of course, since we've interviewed Heston Blumenthal and other people from that space, we really had to go. So here we are talking with Sean Brock at an extraordinarily old-fashioned building, cooking very modern.
Historic.
Food.
It's a historic building.
What did I say it was?
Old-fashioned.
Oh, well, I was trying to compare old-fashioned versus newfangled.
Okay.
And I thought I did it very well, and so don't wrap my knuckles too much. Here's Sean McGrady. Oh, I called him Sean McGrady on tape. He's actually Sean Brock. And the restaurant's name, if you pronounce it as it's spelled, it's McCready's. Apparently everybody in Charleston calls it McCready's.
On the menu has just landed in Charleston, South Carolina, a place that we love. And we have a new experience. I've been eyeing this man's career and this restaurant for a while now. Sean Brock is the chef. Hello, Sean.
Hey, hello.
There's so much to talk about here. McCready's itself is an historic building, and you have a little sheet that outlines the history. Is there some way you can kind of condense it? It dates from the 1788 by Edward McGrady, and
right.
Then what?
Starting in 1788, Edward McCready purchased the building. He was a Madeira exporter, importer, and he needed a place to sell his goods. And so he kind of created this tavern, McCready's Tavern, and it eventually became this political hangout with all the really important Charlestonians here hanging out, drinking, and making decisions. And so really, since, you know, the late 1700s, this building has served food or drink, so that makes it really, really special for us.
Well, it's a fabulous structure. I mean, you can see all the history in it, and you've utilized, for example, the old kitchen is now your dining room, and you were saying you have a private dining room where for 12 that's a very high end.
Right. You know, it's one of those restaurants where you walk in and you immediately know that you're somewhere special.
Yes, exactly.
You know, it has that feel to it. It has that look to it. It has that nostalgic, you know, atmosphere that money can't buy.
Yeah, I'd like to live in that special room with that the glassware and the china and the silver. Now, how did you get here, Sean? You came from a culinary school.
Right. You know, I went to culinary school here in Charleston and immediately fell in love with the city. Like a lot of people do. And I lived here for 3 years while I was in school working at Peninsula Grill. And then I had an opportunity to take a sous chef position at in Richmond, Virginia at the Jefferson Hotel. And that was a really, really, really incredible experience. And then from there, I was asked to go be the opening chef at the age of 24 at the Hermitage Hotel, which was built in 1910. So you kind of see this pattern of I like the really old nostalgic buildings and restaurants. And so, you know, over that 6 year period that I was away from Charleston, in the back of my mind, I knew that I wouldn't be happy unless I was living in Charleston. And so
I'd like to live here, too. Can't afford it.
I got really lucky. I was in the right place at the right time. And I heard that there was an opening at McCready's, and I was the first person to call. ironically. So
now, let's talk a little bit about your style of cooking. Don't hate me if I ask you to explain your style.
That's really an extremely difficult question for me that I get asked all the time. But
there's a lot of experimental. But we had this conversation that, and some of the people that you admire are in the field of molecular gastronomy. But you said that there was the earth grounded you.
Right.
Why don't you just tell us your own interpretation of your style of cooking?
I think my style of cooking is defined by three words: products, ideas, and execution. Those three
Beautiful.
Words are in my mind all day from the time I wake up to the time I go to sleep. And in that order, they are in my mind. And every decision I make, those three words are ringing in my head, you know, which starting with products, you know, that's why we have our own garden. That's why we're raising our own pigs.
Oh, you're doing your own pigs too.
We've recently purchased several pigs, and we're going to start really doing some experimental feeding.
And yeah, I think what kind of pigs are they?
They're a Yorkshire pig.
And that's where Peter's from, you know?
And we're also going to get some Duroc pigs. But we're starting small. And again, it's a great example of forward thinking. Forward thinking doesn't have to be just about using molecular gastronomy to manipulate food on the plate. I think forward thinking can also be about, it can go further than that. It can be creating a garden and growing the varieties that you want to grow and getting the team involved and raising pigs with a diet. I think that's equally as exciting, and it is forward thinking. So we really start with the products, and then the ideas part of that statement. That's where the creativity comes in. That's where we need to set ourselves apart from the next guy, because anybody can cook simple food. And we know that, so in our eyes, it's important to make our food unique, and that's where really creativity comes in, and that molecular gastronomy mindset. You know, we're not pushing it that far, but we will surprise you in new ways, because I think dining needs to be exciting. It needs to be entertainment. You know, there needs to be emotions involved, and there's all these things in this huge equation that make up a dinner, and then the last would be execution. And that's really where modern technology comes in for us. We would be silly to not utilize modern day technology. It allows us to cook with precision. It allows us to cook almost carefree, because everything is computerized, and it's really, really, really.
I saw that great platter of steaks going by that were already vacuum sealed, seasoned, and ready for sous vide.
Well, it really allows us to cook with consistency. And every great chef knows, and every diner knows, that consistency is extremely important in this industry. And what this equipment allows us to do is cook with that precision. You know, short ribs is a great example. You know, a lot of people are taught to cook short ribs in the oven with liquid, and you set your oven at 300, 320 degrees, and you braise it until it's tender. Well, that's delicious. It's delicious. But for me, like, I need to understand exactly what's going on a molecular level, what temperature collagen and elastin melts, what temperature fat turns from solid to liquid. At what temperatures do the cell walls begin contracting? At what temperatures do proteins coagulate? All these things, once you begin to understand them, really allow you to have the ultimate control over cooking. And then once you take all those variables and this huge equation of braising short ribs and you figure everything out, then you can decide on one temperature, and you set this computer at that temperature, and it's cooked that way every single time, no matter who cooks it.
That's brilliant. I'm assuming you're a fan of Harold McGee.
Absolutely. He is a sweetheart, and I've had the pleasure of meeting him a few times, and just what an incredible person. We're really, as chefs, we're so lucky to have him as a reference. Not just his book, but his website and his columns.
The columns are great.
They're unbelievable, and he's so good about answering emails, random, off-the-wall questions. So we should all be very thankful for Harold McGee.
Well, he and Heston are great buddies. And
I can see that.
And also Wiley, who's
of course.
A fan of Wiley's, a friend of Wiley's, too. So, well, in this context, Sean, I'm sitting here. You gave me some sample menus. Could you pick a few items and sort of describe them in the context of what you're talking about, your three priorities?
Absolutely. Actually, we can start with the very first dish on the menu, and it's a project that we've been working on for several months, and it's the idea of taking something that's ancient, something that's really, really, really old, and that's the art of charcuterie. And for us, it's great on many different levels, but once you start raising whole animals, and that whole animal is your responsibility, your cooking has to change a little bit. It's gone are the days of picking up the phone and only ordering the tenderloins. You know, that's delicious, but I think it's a bit irresponsible.
And we just interviewed Fergus Henderson.
Well, then.
And I had my first pig's tail.
Yeah, what he says is if you're going to kill a pig, you should at least be polite enough to eat all the parts.
Exactly. And so what we've been doing in preparation of our pig farm project is we've been getting whole animals in and using them nose to tail, just like Fergus. And that's really, really been an incredible learning experience for us and everyone in the, but I think what we're going to do differently and what we are doing differently is applying forward thinking and applying a scientific mind to all this crazy enzyme technology and bacteria technology and to really, really, really make some really incredible charcuterie. And so for us, it's been a really great project that we're just now getting into that I really see taking off.
Do you have a drying room or curing room?
We do have a curing room that's beautiful, and it's one of those things where I could be having the worst day and be really upset, and all I got to do is just walk into that room of charcuterie and smell it and see it and touch it. It's like yoga. It's like zen-like. It's really, really, really
good. So now what? So you apply your science to that too, though.
You know, everything that we do, we want it to appear to be simple, and we want it to be, underlying it's really, really complex as far as the ideas and the execution. So we want to really, really, really make sure that we're executing everything the best that we can. And so everything is really, really detailed, and everything is put under a microscope, but we don't want our food to be something sterile, something without soul, something that is strange. We want to cook food that makes people feel really good and that they want to come back and eat time and time and time again. We have a really big restaurant. We need to pack it every single night.
How many covers do you have?
You know, a lot of people think I'm crazy because the style of food we do should be reserved for restaurants that do 80 to 100 covers a night. We do upwards of 250 covers, sometimes 300. So it's challenging. But
are they local, or is this a destination restaurant just because
of
you?
You know, I think
you're nominated, I might say, for Rising Star Chef.
I think it's 50-50. Charleston has always blown me away with its ability to support local restaurants. It is unbelievable the amount of restaurants we have here that are expensive restaurants that stay packed every single night with locals. So I think Charleston is a very serious food city.
Yeah, I think it is too. And it's getting just one of the very best food and wine festivals, and we trot around to a lot of them, is the one that's fairly young here, but still very well organized and very well received.
Next year is going to be our fourth year, and it just keeps getting better. And so, that's how everything works. You know, last year was so much fun. It was so much fun. And next year is going to be awesome.
Now, is there anything special that you'd like to mention from these menus that's one of your special favorite things to do?
Well, you know, our menu is driven by, first of all, our garden. So when we go out in the mornings and pick, then we make a list of everything that we're, and then we make another list of everything from our neighbor's gardens. And these are gardens in walking distance from ours. So we're really focusing on trying to create a closed circle between this restaurant, the customers, and these farms. I think it's really, really, really important on many, many, many different levels. last year there was a stat that blew my mind. 5% of the food that we eat in Charleston comes from South Carolina. Not just Charleston, but South Carolina. And so that really, really, really upset me.
Oh, that's terrible.
And even for school lunches.
That's off-beat with the rest of the country, isn't
it? So even for school lunches and things. So there are some new programs. Low Country Local First is starting a new program. There's some sustainable seafood initiatives. So we're moving in the right direction.
And it's funny because it's not as difficult to, you should try growing in southwestern Pennsylvania. Uh-huh. In Charleston, you have a much longer season. But a friend of mine who went to work at Primo in Florida, in Orlando, said that she had the same thing happen. You know, she's at Melissa Kelly restaurant, and there was nothing being grown. And that, look at the climate.
Right.
So now they have a garden out back, too.
Well, I think that in the last 2 years, you know, I've been spending a lot of time driving around and hanging out at every vegetable farm here and talking to these guys and working for free and just getting to know them and really trying to understand them and really trying to convince them that there is a market for it here. All these chefs are flying things in from California, from Chef's Garden. It's really, really, really upsetting because we have incredible soil, incredible growing conditions, incredible sun. We have pretty much a 12-month growing season here. So we're really, really shooting ourselves in the foot. So for us, we really want to stick to cooking things that come from a 50-mile radius. And that's really, really, really tough, especially when you get into proteins. And that's our biggest hurdle right now, but we're moving forward. And I think the important thing is that we're moving forward and we're trying. And we know what our future is. And I think that's better than not trying and not knowing what your future is.
Yeah, well, it's so exciting talking to you. And this is such an exciting dining scene. Am I missing asking a perfect question to you to reveal of yourself?
Well, you know, what's amazing about this restaurant and what's amazing about this community is we have such a bright future, and there's so much to look forward to, and we're just going at an incredible rate. You can walk up and down these streets all over the place and sit down and have an incredible meal.
Oh, it's true.
And what's a lot different about this city than most cities is the camaraderie of all the local chefs is really, really, really incredible. So I think people really need to see how special this city is as far as food is concerned.
Well, I agree. I'm here, mm-hmm. and we're here a lot. And I look forward to, are we doing a tasting menu?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, that'll be fun. Thanks for talking to us, and I look forward to sampling it.
Sounds great.
And good luck.
Thank you.
Chef Sean's just turns out he's just nuts about vegetables. So, of course, his first plate was vegetables on little sticks. But later on, we had a absolutely delicious short rib dish. Somewhere in there, there was a...
Well, the carrot was right out of his garden.
Right.
Baby carrot. The classic radish with butter.
There you go. One of the more innovative courses was a block of super hot marble, red marble, on which you cooked your tuna to your satisfaction, which is not very much. So, no, a really innovative place. Excellent service. Food matched with wine. Just a very enjoyable evening that we had.
And now, the people that remember at the next table had been married there 5 years ago, which was before of the current chef, and they said that it was infinitely better with the new chef.
And now the new chef is cooking desserts in Houston, I think. But anyway, it's time to take a break now, so let's do it. Let's go do that. We'll see you on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and I think that we probably didn't even say that at the beginning of the program.
I don't think we did. I also understand and pointed out that I misspoke just before the break, and I said the new chef at McGrady's is cooking in a restaurant in Houston. Obviously, that's not true. It's the previous chef. I think his name is Michael Kramer, who's now in Houston, having been at McGrady's for several years. And the people at the next table did indeed say they thought it was very much better now, and they had a wonderful time.
And it's always been good, yeah.
And we had a wonderful time,
of
course, because we do that. Next up, we actually weren't very far away from Creedy's, because a lot of the restaurants in Charleston are clustered around East Bay Street, but we were on a little street in what they call the French Quarter, called Exchange Street, at a restaurant called Carolina's, which under another name was one of the very first, if you like, that you can call modern restaurants in Charleston, recently revived, and we had the opportunity to talk to Chef Jeremiah Bacon, who was lured all the way back from New York City to Charleston, his home city, to start cooking this restaurant. They only just started opening for lunch just a few weeks ago, and we had the opportunity to catch up with Jeremiah right after lunch.
I've always said I'm a firm believer in the how much what you do in your life is influenced by your name. So we're talking to Chef Jeremiah Bacon, who should have been just directed to chefdom anyhow if he were not a pig farmer. Hello, Jeremiah.
How are you doing?
Now, the restaurant itself is iconic in Charleston. Why is it spelled that way, by the way, with an apostrophe? Carolina's?
Yes.
What does that mean?
You know, I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I don't know with the apostrophe.
Anyhow,
on that.
It's I'm sure property.
It is. It's
can
restaurant.
Can you condense its history for us?
It was originally called the Perditas Restaurant.
Okay.
I think it opened in 1953, and it was one of three only places to eat in town. Sort of classically French influenced.
Oh, it was French.
Yes, ma'am. So over the years, it's sort of, I guess within the last 15 years, it took a little bit different identity, early 80s, mid 80s. It was Southern cuisine.
And it's certainly Southern now, but with a little twist.
It is. And, you know, I tend to refer to it as Southern in the sense that we look to local ingredients. We look to Southern ingredients, regional ingredients here.
Low country, definitely.
Yep. And that provides sort of a structure and sort of a backbone for what we do. If you were to ask me if it's stereotypical Southern food, I'd say no.
Yeah, because you've had a lot of different history. You were a local boy, which everybody made a lot of fuss about because they love to have local boys back home.
It was good to come
back.
But
you went off.
I did.
You went off to New York.
I did, yes, ma'am.
But you had a philosophy degree in between, which I find the most amazing chefs have degrees like, astrophysics and philosophy.
Yeah,
but anyhow, but you also have a culinary degree from the Culinary Institute in Hyde Park.
Yes, ma'am.
And then you worked in New York at really fabulous places.
Yeah, I did my externship at the River Cafe in Brooklyn with Rick Lochinen, and he was one of the guest instructors that came up to the school and did a demo, and I was blown away. I mean, his of all the demonstrations I'd seen in the theater there, his food was just very involved, had a French influence to it. He's worked in France quite a few years. He worked with Ducasse.
Now, you were at Le Bernardin. What was that like? Because that's probably our favorite New York restaurant.
That was fantastic. It really was.
Eric,
it's intense.
Eric?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. I love seafood. I mean, I grew up here. Grew up off of John's Island, fishing, shrimping. I tell you, one thing that's kind of interesting, you don't see fresh shrimp up there. Cause it's,
you mean New York?
In New York. No.
It's, the shrimp here is just out of this world.
It is. And it fluctuates throughout the year. Right now we're seeing the white rose shrimp just coming into season. Three or four days ago they just opened it up. So I just got a delivery yesterday.
The shrimp has roe. Do you use the roe?
You can. Yes, ma'am. Absolutely.
I've never seen roe on shrimp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's on their little bellies coming in.
Did I have any of that?
You did not. You would have seen it. You would have seen it on
it's
there.
It's coral.
Yes. It will cook to the coral color.
Oh, I have to look into that. I've never had that.
And that's what we'll see right now. As the water gets warmer, they'll head out to sea looking for the cooler water, and you'll start seeing brown shrimp, which are a little bit smaller. They tend to be a touch sweeter. So some people prefer the brown shrimp over the white shrimp. And then you'll see the sort of cycle complete. The roe shrimp this fall coming back in that were,
I don't know why nobody's ever given me roe shrimp at all. But
yeah. When we have it in, when we have it, we it's on there. We leave it on there.
That's great.
Yeah.
So you were at Per Se. That must have been an experience.
It was.
Did you fish there, too?
I did. A gentleman named Philip Tessier. He and I both came over from Le Bernardin. We both worked on the fish station there. Absolutely incredible experience.
But you're happy to be home.
I am. I was gone 10 years. I was in New York City
for... Oh, that long?
Yes, ma'am. I was in New York City for 8 years, and I was in Boston and Martha's Vineyard for 2 years. And so, yeah, it was a good run. It was a good run. New York was pretty incredible. I was up there last September. We were up at the Beard House, and was there for a week. Had a great time, but...
Isn't that kitchen a hoot?
You know, compared to what our kitchen is, I thought it was pretty big. So
really? Oh, I haven't looked at your kitchen. You live really tiny. This is a very large restaurant, but you have a tiny kitchen.
It is. Well, we just changed it in February. We knocked a wall down, so we opened it up a little bit. But before that, it was a our cooking space was a third of that. So
Jeez,
it made the Beard kitchen look
oh, that's absolutely
huge.
Now, your signatures, everything I read says that you follow low country cuisine, but you modernize it and lighten it up. Could you give us an example of that?
And again, I look to what we get here regionally. Charleston and Low Country areas, very rich agricultural history. I mean, and being a port city, we get the seafood, we get all the port influences. Farms here, they're amazing. I mean, I've got, four or five farms right off Wabamala and Johns Island that we're constantly getting seafood in, vegetables and produce in. Yesterday just got some patty pan squash, squash blossoms, crooknecks, baby crooknecks, baby zucchinis. We're growing some rice up at a Kensington plantation.
I guess you would grow rice.
We should, that harvest should be mid-June, actually. Hopefully about 7,000 pounds.
An amazing salad with heirloom radishes.
Yes,
they were fabulous.
Yeah, we're getting those from Thackeray Farms on Wabamala Island. And then, of course, the heads-on shrimp you had. I just got that yesterday from...
The shrimp salad with the radishes was extraordinary. And then we had the classic shrimp and grits.
Shrimp and grits.
Just perfectly executed. But it was not tampered with. It was a traditional recipe.
It is. We've done a few things different with the sauce. I mean, we make the traditional shrimp stock, and we use that. So, you're going to find a few items on the menu that will always be on the menu. Crab cakes, we'll always have crab cakes. We sort of change the recipe a little bit. We're putting different, I've just got some fresh lump crab meat from North Carolina. So hopefully getting, setting up that as a constant source of crab meat. And sometimes there's a lot of legwork setting those things up. But, recipes, we're changing those a little bit with some of the classics, but the accompaniments always change seasonally. We try to be a very seasonally driven menu.
Well, that's perfect for a place where you grow things 12 months out of the year. We must say that we love the fried oysters, the truffled parmesan fries, I'm not so sure about.
Well, I tell you what.
I don't like truffle oil very much because of the chemicals in it.
Yeah, well, those have been
a huge hit.
They really have.
I'm
and
sure
we put just a little bit of the truffle on, just sort of to perfume it.
Yeah. And what else do we have? The shrimp salad, as I said, was really excellent. Yeah. Is there something you particularly are proud of and you'd like to mention to our listeners?
As far as the lunch menu, dinner menu, or
dinner menu, which we didn't get because we just did lunch. What about dinner menu?
I tell you, the groupers just—it's become sort of a new classic. It's just local grouper. We get it from a fellow named Mark Marhefka over in Shem Creek. We've got celeriac mashed potatoes. We use the local petite vegetables.
Yeah, you like celeriac. I've seen that.
I do. I like it for quite a few things. I mean, we even use it in our stocks. There's a sweetness to it we get, and we get that celery flavor, but a little bit sweeter. Yeah, I think celeriac's underrated. It should be used.
No, I like it. Well, anyhow, well, we certainly enjoyed our visit here, and I appreciate you taking the time.
Well, it's our pleasure.
To talk to us. And listeners, you want some sort of lightened up but still very tasty low country cuisine, come to Carolina's in Charleston, South Carolina. Thanks, Chef.
Thank you so much.
Well, moving right along, what's treat we had with our tour of the Wentworth Mansion, cocktails with the owners, and then interviewing with the chef.
Now this is the next. This is the next day. You understand? I don't want you to think we ate ourselves silly.
Oh no!
Because we had lunch at Carolina's. We did have dinner that evening at the restaurant called Fig. And by the way, and unfortunately, due to a technical problem, the interviewer Fig is unusable, and we're going to have to record it again. So that was an adventure along the way that took place between lunching at Carolina's and dining at Circa 1886. And it's a little way across town, too, because the Wentworth Mansion is part of a newer part of Charleston. It was only built in 1886, for heaven's sake. Almost,
it's around the medical center, right?
Almost a new building. It's right next to the College of Charleston is where it's located, and it's to the west of the center of the city. And it is absolutely monstrous. I mean, it is a huge building, delightfully renovated as a bed and breakfast. I understand it's the second largest house in Charleston.
The person who built it was Nouveau Riche and had 12 children. I guess that explains it.
Yeah, I understand from what I've been researching that the largest house in Charleston is the Calhoun Mansion, which is on Meeting Street. But that's a story for another day altogether. Circa 1886 is the name of the restaurant. It's in what was the carriage house in the garden.
What a charming place.
Yeah, in the garden of the mansion, and a young man in the kitchen who's doing an exceptionally fine job. And why don't we just listen to what he has to say about it?
Sounds good to me. Mark Collins, executive chef at Circa 1886. You've told me a little bit about your background, and you certainly have to be a lot older than what you look. Yeah. I should mention that this restaurant is at the Wentworth Mansion, which is probably one of the most gorgeous properties I've seen in Charleston. It's a B&B or luxury hotel.
Small luxury inn, yeah.
Yeah, it's a luxury hotel is what it is, and it really is luxurious. We'll talk about that later with the owner. But let's talk about this restaurant, which is in the carriage house on this one-acre property, I believe. It is 1 acre.
Yep.
You grew up shivering in Lake Erie, or in Erie, PA.
Yep.
You went to culinary school in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. I hope all of your old colleagues are listening to this. then you went south, and coming from Erie, I don't blame you a bit. You went to Texas.
Yep.
And then what? Tell us about that.
I moved to Texas just for experience. Again, got done with culinary college, so to speak. Basically, I had 3 years of vocational culinary school in high school. And
you were 23 and executive chef of where?
The Fairmont Hotel in San Antonio. So, and that was a 32-room hotel. It gave me a lot of opportunities to create and be creative. But we did continental flair. Try to stay away from the Southwest, but occasionally use that at times just because in that locale it worked. But then after that, decided, I'd seen Texas, enjoyed it a lot, decided to spread my wings some more and come up with a town that maybe would give me the ability to be far more creative and think a little bit further outside the box. And Charleston became that city.
And so you decided your niche was the small luxury hotel niche?
Mm-hmm. With that, you have a captured audience that is the clientele you might be looking for to be more approachable with your food. And that offers, I think, that dynamics.
Well, the whole area of Charleston is becoming a big food city.
It is. It's a big dining
destination.
You're
in the right place.
Oh, yes.
As I said, as young as you must be pretty good. I'm looking forward to having dinner here tonight. We're going to do a tasting menu. What is the style of this restaurant?
When I first came on board, the overall theme and feeling of the restaurant was supposed to be, historic Charleston cuisine, but definitely updated for today's tastes and flavors. So what I try to do is find out what's traditional Southern American, let's say. Everything from like fried chicken to, collard greens.
I like collard greens.
They're great.
Yeah.
And then, on top of that, we also look historically into like what was coming through Charleston when 200 years ago it was the largest seaport on the eastern seaboard. So we had a lot of French influence, a lot of influence from India, spices coming through here, Caribbean influences too. So all of those things melt together into what we consider our cuisine today.
Uh-huh. And that sort of marks your personal style as well?
Yeah, I rely kind of heavily in French influences, just from some of the restaurants I've worked at and the training that I got. But I try to, again, get creative with the flavors and the sauces. I've always, at a young age, decided to use fruit in a lot of my preparations. So I like to use, fresh fruit sauces with flavored with this or that to kind of make a little more savory sauce. But it gives people flavors they're maybe not used to seeing more so in desserts instead of an entree or an appetizer kind of setup.
Now it's turning around. You're getting all the savories for desserts.
Yes, yes. And I don't know if that works quite as well, but you know, some people obviously play that.
So we're going to have this tasting menu. Can you just give us a little preview of what we might be eating?
Well, we just changed our menu out here recently, and we've obviously lightened it for the hotter months here. So we have Carolina striped bass.
Oh, wow.
Which is farm-raised here, and we take that and sear it and serve that on a artichoke potato cake. And then we make what's called a piccalilli, which is a fine brunoise of vegetables. Of basically use cucumber and red bell pepper and some olive oil cured black olives.
Oh, wow.
That are minced up too. And then we finish that with some organic watercress.
Sounds good to me. What else are we going to have?
We do a little tasting of beef too as well. We're doing a culotte of beef that's braised very, very slow and low. That's served with pickled onions on top. And then we also have a grilled beef tenderloin with a golden raisin jam. And so that's, again, sort of those influences of jams being of the South, and we like that sort of sweetness. And raisins can be found in steaks, sauces. So that sort of was our go-to there for a flavor combination with some fresh local asparagus. All those things really tie in well for the spring and summer months.
Now, who are some of your icons? Who would you consider a mentor, for example? And do you have icons in the chef world?
Well, you know, starting off in the age I was in, it was really creative cuisines was starting to kind of happen, and the whole squeeze bottle phenomena kind of came into play.
Squiggles.
Yeah, so, you know, Jean-Georges was probably one of my biggest influences early on. I liked his creative approach to cooking and the way he made flavored oils and kind of extracted all those things, and he was kind of a pioneer in those days.
He sure has turned a lot of star chefs out of his kitchen.
Boy, has he ever. Charlie Trotter, another one, I think that his eye for, you know, putting a nice painting on a plate also kind of helped evolve my cuisine and my styles, too. I think those were really good foundation as far as grand chefs go. But I've had some great mentors in my time that have really pushed me to be better and better at what I do and to take a better approach to just work ethics in general. To
anyone
make sure.
I know?
We have a gentleman named Santiago de la Cruz, who I met in Texas, and he works down at a country club down there. And his philosophy was looking at things five or six different ways before you plate something up. And that kind of plays through with everything that I do. It allows you to see things just so many different ways and allows you to pick the best way possible. So he was a great mentor. I had a chef named David Spadafore who went to the Culinary Olympics in Germany and got a gold medal. He went over on it with the airplane, 2 weeks or 2 months worth of product ready to go for the Olympics, and it all got lost.
Oh, I've heard that those stories all of the time.
Yeah, he had about 2 weeks in which to put it all together, and he did it, and he won a gold medal. So,
oh, wow.
When I was in high school, I got to work with him I was a dishwasher for him, but I was going to a vocational culinary school too. So he understood what I wanted in life and really kind of pushed me and opened my eyes up and allowed me to see things. I got to help him with competitions. So I got to see a lot of fine, fine food at a very young age, and it helped expose me to that.
Is there something that you'd like to experiment with or putter around with that you're looking at in the future?
Well, you know, right now the whole, chemistry kind of food is big right now. And so to stay on the cutting edge and to play with the rest of the guys out there that are younger than I and that are coming out that are doing all this nouveau kind of food, we're looking into what these chemicals are, and they're found in everyday things. So to say that they're chemicals is kind of not a good choice of words. I mean, basically they're using seaweed and
agar-agar
and things like that, but they're using them in very unique ways. And so, you know, obviously growing up when I did, those things weren't necessarily available, and I didn't work with any chefs that were that avant-garde using those things, you know.
And they don't probably cover that much of Pennsylvania color.
No, probably not. I'm going to have to go to El Bulli or something like that to figure that all out, or some of the other great places here in the States. But that seems to be a growing trend, and I'm not necessarily feel that it works for all preparations, and so we try and find out the best uses for the ingredients and see how they could work better towards cleaning up our cuisine in a sense and making it even purer or more refined.
Do you do a lot with game?
Well, I have antelope on the menu right now.
Oh, that's great.
And it's from South Texas. It's the one thing I took when I left Texas, and it's been on the menu ever since I moved to Charleston. So we always have antelope fillets on the menu that we do in some sort of preparation. Currently, we have it with some stewed southern white cheddar and rosemary waffle.
That sounds good.
Yeah, a little savory kind of waffle. gives you some crunch factor. And then also we have seared cast iron seared Vidalia onions that are grown locally, and they're more like a large green onion. They're a little bit different Vidalia. And then it's served with a peach Merlot sauce, again with that fruit influence that we have.
Well, I'm excited about this, and I'm sure Peter, who's fiddling with buttons, is excited too. And I look forward to it, and thanks for talking to us,
Mark. Well, thank you for having us on the program.
Well, it was a lovely meal in an absolutely exquisite setting. It was so much fun.
And let's not forget, on the menu had a new adventure right after that, because in order for us to get back to where we were staying, the people from circa 1886 called a rickshaw.
Oh, that was right. I forgot about that.
So that was a very, very pleasant way to ride down Wentworth Street all
with
the way.
With a bicycle.
Just a very short distance back to our hotel, pedaled by a young man who said he was a student, and this is the way he was working his way through school.
He had good calf muscles.
Yeah, all in all, a wonderful evening, and we're so grateful to Rick and Lynn, his wife, for their hospitality. And they said, you didn't get to stay here this time, you absolutely have to come here next time.
So we'll
do that, and you should do that too. And now it's time to
take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Hello, hello again. I'm going to throw our email address out there one more time, just so you know. I guess I haven't thrown it out at all this time. Email us onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. And now it's time to catch up with an old friend of ours, Chef Bob Wagner. We adore him.
Yes, we do, and he sets a mean table at the Charleston Grill in the Charleston Place Hotel. But we talked to him about another new adventure, and it's self-explanatory, so why don't we just go to the tape.
Chef Bob Wagner, hello, hello again.
Oh, my gosh. Thanks for having me.
It's so good to be back, and for so long now enjoyed your wonderful cuisine. And now you're giving other people a chance to have your sensibility and your menus and your recipes in the Charleston Grill at Charleston Place cookbook, which is subtitled French-Influenced Low Country Cuisine, which is what you cook, right?
And now you can do it all at home from your kitchen at home.
Do you think people really will do this at home?
Well, they do and have, and people love it. It's done real well, and it's just been out a little while here. But, honestly, I did a book so that people could do something. I didn't want a book that sits out and people look at the pictures and say, oh, that's a pretty book, but where am I going to find that? I can't get that.
Exactly.
Where are you going to get this? And the one bonus on mine is I went to all my purveyors that I've been buying for 10 years and said, you know what? I'm doing a recipe. I'm using your lamb. I'm using your beef tongue. I'm using your stone crabs. I'm using your scallops. I want people to be able to get these same products, not have to go to their local supermarket and be disappointed with them. So you know what? I'm going to put your name at the back of with a purveyor's list, and everyone that buys this book can call you and say, I want the lamb that Bob uses in the recipe, and you're going to send it to them. And they all said, okay.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, so every purveyor that I use, the same lamb that I've had on my menu for 10 years and just done differently from, dry-aged Colorado lamb from Colorado, you can call the guy. It's not going to be cheap, but you can still go away going, man, that is just, that's the same product, and it's amazing, and you can call them up, email them, and get the same product.
Now, one of the more amazing things about this book is everyone should know that you are also, in addition to being a talented chef, you are an incredible photographer.
Well, I don't know about incredible, but
I had a good time. Is food photography your specialty?
Not at all. Not at all. This is my first. This is my first feat. I took over our dining room table for about 6 months, and
it's hard.
My wife wasn't real. Food photography is crazy, but it's not. You know, it's. I don't want to put down these. You know, these people that show up with their paint brushes and a little olive oil and butter ice cream and making all these fake things that go with it. I would just bring home a dish every night. Kind of half done, set it up, and I'd have stacks of tablecloths, that I'd have a different tablecloth, a different plate, a different look. And
So you did all the styling yourself, and I did it at home.
I'd set it up, take a picture, go
your
up on the computer.
Must have been ready to kill you.
Oh, she was crazy. She was crazy with it. We didn't have anybody over for 6 months, I guarantee you that.
Here, Peter.
What?
I just wanted to add a comment because we've photographed Bob's food here in the restaurant, and it is extraordinarily photogenic anyway. So it's not, he didn't have to change the food preparation to make it good. He just had to master the art of taking the picture, and I think he already knew how to do that.
Yeah.
Now, bear in mind, this is a man who has his own TV channel on Charleston Place Television. So you can see a lot of Bob Agnew if you'd like to. You can spend your whole time staying here, sitting in your room.
Watching
Uncle Bob on television.
Now, how did you organize this? I'm looking here. You have appetizers. Then you have an unusual category, breakfast.
Breakfast. No one has any breakfast recipes. I mean, there's lovely. No. I love French toast, the true way that the French make French
pain
toast.
Perdu.
The pain perdu, which is usually the old, you know, old tired dried bread, you know, that's just gently soaked in milk and then egg. And then what you do is sprinkle it with brown sugar. So there's no maple syrup. There's no, you know, any kind of syrup of any kind in France. And putting that in the pan will caramelize that sugar on top of it. So you get all that tiny sweetness and a crust, almost like a creme brulee of French bread, if you will. And oh my gosh, it's so good. And
I've never had anything that good.
Oh, you got to give it a try. You got to give it a try.
Well,
and there's eggs, dishes, and omelets and things. I think there's some simple things that people want to know how to do. And most of the dishes in there, you can literally go to the supermarket, buy the product, or call the purveyors that I put in the back there, and come home and do it. Most are half-page, you know, recipes. They're spelt out pretty easily, so you can kind of come home and do it. And you know, there's some more difficult and kind of wacky ones in there for the true, I want to be a crazy cook, you know, with a little bit longer preparations. But in general, they're pretty straightforward and easy enough to do.
You have a section of vegetables. I just think you handle vegetables particularly well, and I don't know why. What in your background? I mean, I die and dream of your collards.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, and the collards are in there, too.
I see you have them here braised in Palmetto amber beer.
Yeah, we've got our local amber beer that's part of the recipe, and that one that makes them just so incredibly wonderful. But there's a lot. I think people are afraid of vegetables, don't know how to do a lot of vegetables, and it's rare to find vegetable preparations in books. And now we're finding a lot of vegetarians, you know, or people that just want to, they can cook, or you know, dad can get out there and grill a steak, but what do we put with it? A baked potato? You know how that it gets old after a while.
Well,
so
there are more books coming out.
Oh, a lot.
Attest to that.
Oh, yeah.
Vegetarian, vegan,
exactly.
And I told you gluten-free.
Gluten-free. Got to get those gluten-free's in there,
boy.
Too.
Salads. You're also big on salads.
I love salads.
Huge variety of salads.
Yeah,
Is that because of all those years you spent in France?
You know, the French don't do a lot of mixed or different kind of salads, really. Usually they're pretty traditional and simple with their salads. Yeah. I think that's more a California kick that kind of brought that on.
You're from California, that's
exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Original in California, so with a French background and just... And I love fun salads. I think it's a fun way of throwing in another course or another little small portion of something.
I want this one. Fried low country oyster and white asparagus salad in a Chardonnay anchovy and roasted walnut cream.
There you go.
That's gorgeous.
All the good stuff.
Yeah. And then you have soups.
Got to have some soups. Always have a couple cold soups, too. It's rare, I think, to get a cold soup in a restaurant, too, or at least a good cold soup.
Uh-huh.
So there's a couple cold soups.
Do you do fruit soups, too? I hate fruit soups.
No, don't do a fruit soup.
Okay. And then meat and game. Have you seen what's his name's book on After the Hunt?
John Falls.
John Falls.
Oh, no.
It weighs 11 pounds.
Oh, good God.
So game is very big in the
game
South.
Game is big.
Also.
There's a lot of hunters that want to know how to cook their deer that they shoot every year. So if there's anything you can do to make a piece of deer meat taste good, they're all excited about it.
Yeah, and you have good stuff like rabbit in here, too.
Oh, yeah.
And then you have a huge section of fish.
Got to have some fish. I'll always, and as we said, also there's a photo with every recipe also. I have trouble reading a recipe if there's not a photo next to it to kind of keep you occupied.
Right.
Maybe you call me a kid, but, you know, I want to at least have somewhat of an idea what I'm trying to build. It may not look exactly the same, but you can flip through and go, well, that doesn't look so bad. Oh, that, I think I can do that. But if there's no photo, I think people just move along and, you know, and pass right on through. But I think the eye catchers photo that'll kind of catch your eye, and every recipe's got an image with it, which that's what
I
said.
I mean, and for cookbooks, I had special requests from people for books with pictures because they don't like cookbooks without pictures. And then, now, are these your recipes for desserts or that genius tour de force?
No, actually, all my recipes. All my recipes. There's a true creme brulee that came straight from France with my little tweaks on it. There's actually a crepe recipe with sweet grits, if you can imagine, kind of praline grits and chocolate sauce, and sort of my play on southern fun desserts. When have you ever had sweet grits before? So that was a lot of fun stuff.
Well,
something different.
Well, no, I mean, it's like rice pudding, same thing. Yeah. Concept. So now your foreword was by Coleman Andrews from Savour.
Yeah.
And he's a regular columnist in Gourmet. And he starts out by saying, Bob Wagner is a southern boy just like me. We're both from Southern California. But you really absorbed the flavors of the South.
Oh, yeah. I'm as southern as they get now. Along with my sous chef, Michelle Weaver, who's been with me for 13 years now, who's from Decatur, Alabama. Is a big part of why we're so very southern, and she keeps me thinking south even when I don't want to. When the French comes out in me.
This one looks good too. I mean, the photos are so spectacular. And then I look and it's chilled southern smoked chicken, endive, California or Carolina shrimp salad, and a yogurt and virgin walnut oils. What could be wrong with that one? Or your soft shell crab salad.
Oh, you got to have some soft shells if you're down here.
You like soft shells.
Oh my gosh, I love them.
I do too.
That's the tough thing is they're just not around too long. But there's a side of that I like, because now we've gotten to a point where you can buy raspberries all year long. You can buy apples all year long.
And they're not so special.
Exactly, and it's not so special. But soft shells, you want fresh soft shells, you got to be here at the right time. You got to.
Well, now we have this on our website, I believe. OTM bookshelf, and I think that anybody who buys this book, you're just—it's just worth just the cooking from it. I mean, it's even better than a trip. Yes, I was going to just do that. As a matter of fact, what a nice picture of you, Bob, with your glass of wine. I wanted to ask you—we were last here in August of 07, and I idiotically said, what's new? Has anything happened since then? Of course, there's always something happening here. Tell us a little bit about what's happened here. I have this menu. It's different menus, different purveyors. What else?
Oh, it changed a bunch of things around. And you got to just keep it fresh and keep it moving and keep people excited. I think one thing people really enjoy about the Charleston Grill is that they can come in and see something different. It's not the same menu for the last 5 years or, something. They can come in and just kind of let us cook or see what we've got going on. And we really change it around. Now we've got the pure section, a lush section, a cosmopolitan section, and a southern section on our menu. We can choose from a couple appetizers or soups or salads, then two or three entrees of each, and usually a side dish that goes along with each section also.
I like this side, fried mac and cheese with truffles. It's not low fat.
Oh, no. That's
sure tastes good.
Yeah, that's on our lush side, so that's not so bad. The pure side, we've got, simple peas and carrots, a little fresh thyme, and then we've got our Colorado lamb that's amazing. We've got kahala, a fish coming from Hawaii.
That?
It's a deep water, sustainable farmed fish, if you can imagine. And kahala, or I'm trying to think, kampachi is another word for it, and you watch and see over the next couple of years, this is going to be the next fish, because it's deep water raised in Hawaii and sustainable. So we're not depleting, the fish industry by fishing these. And it's just an amazing, amazing fish.
Yeah, and here's these collard greens. Why I'm fixated on collard greens, I don't know. With Merlot vinegar, that was what we were trying to think of. We were describing this dish to somebody, crispy bacon and fried garlic. And oh, yums, yums, yums.
All the good stuff.
Yeah. Listeners, let's hear a website, Bob.
Actually, if you want to, one thing fun about I lucked out. My next door neighbor has a bookstore called Books Tell You Why, and he helped me out by putting my book on his website. So if you go to chefbobwagner.com and you say, oh, we were there last year, I wish he could autograph it for me. I wish he could say, oh, thanks to Aunt Mary, you're the best, or whatever you want. So you can actually email, go to that website at chefbobwagner, WAGGONER.com, and just say, if you could just sign it to Fred or to Jack or to Joanne, thanks for the great dinner the other night. And he calls me up and says, hey, there's a couple more to sign. And you sign them, and he'll send them off, and you get them easy enough. I was just in Canada, in Toronto last weekend, cooking and doing some events at the Consul General's house with the ambassador, and some people wanted to get the book also. So we've already sent some to Canada over the last couple days.
Now that scene's turning around Toronto, hasn't it?
Crazy how it's turning around.
Isn't it amazing?
Crazy, the scene. They had me do their breakfast TV, the early early morning, which is like the CBS show there. And then we were in a couple of the major supermarkets showcasing some products of the South, kind of help bring people and showcase the Southern, you know, corn and collards and the peppers and things, trying to get them to purchase actually Southern products. And there was, you know, out of 100 people that walked by, 50 had seen me 2 hours earlier on the TV in the morning. So it's a big, they've become big foodies in major, beautiful supermarkets and produce and vegetables and wines alongside. We drove down to Niagara Falls and wineries. So they're catching on. They're coming along. Very Americanized, I must say, too.
Uh-huh.
They're being right there on the border.
Well, Bob, thanks for talking to us again. And listeners, I want to put in a plug also for the hotel, because Charleston Place is a real special place. And we love it here. Peter would like to say something. I'll say goodbye now and pass it to Peter for his comments.
Well, it's not too early to put in a plug for one of the best food and wine festivals in the country, which will take place early March next year. Are you planning anything special for that, Bob? March 2009 for the Charleston area?
We've always got fun stuff planned, and we bring in chefs from all across the country, and what's great about it is it's our little Southern hospitality festival. It's not Miami where 3,000 people go. It's not Aspen where 5,000 people go or 10,000. You can come and actually sit and talk with the chefs. We have dinners in the restaurants with 50 people, you know, and we have cooking demos and cooking competitions, and you can sit around and chat with the chefs rather than see them from afar and never get a chance to talk to them. And the winemakers, the same thing. The winemakers come in and they love the fact that you can sit and talk to people. There's some communication rather than doing a demo for 600 people or a wine tasting for 300. You know, they don't like that either. So
right. They
love our little Southern Food and Wine Festival.
Right. So put that in your calendar. I think it's March 5th through 9th or something like that. You can get the information to the Charleston Food and Wine Festival.com. And On the Menu is going to be there. Chef Bob Wagon is going to be there. So you better be there, too. Bob, thanks so much. A pleasure to catch up with you.
Oh, my gosh. My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, does that wrap it yet?
No, it's time to take another break. But we got one more interview segment coming up. It's probably the most surprising of all the ones we had in Charleston. So we'll keep you in suspense until after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station. www.aspstation.net.
Well,
that was a big sigh.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking. I mean,
how am
I
going to say welcome back?
Welcome back. But
and
don't forget
that email address again, onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com.
I wanted to say something different. If you really are into breakfast, I think the South does that meal segment proud.
It certainly puts hairs on your chest, as they say, with all the wonderful things that they have for breakfast.
Potatoes,
Southern style.
Yes.
But one of the more remarkable things is that a restaurant that we had never heard of before was just recently named as one of the finalists for Best Chef Southeast. A restaurant called Hominy Grill. Now, Hominy Grill is just a little bit different than your regular restaurant that's up for a James Beard Award. But the chef, it turns out, has a fine chefing background, and he's a very interesting fellow to boot. So here's Chef Robert Stelling of Hominy Grill in Charleston, South Carolina. A day or so ago, we walked past a bench on South Market Street, and it says, Forrest Gump sat here. It's in front of a shrimp place that probably doesn't have anything to do with the legend of Forrest Gump, since he doesn't exist anyway. But we're with Bob Stelling, who's the owner of a restaurant called the Hominy Grill. And I said to him just a few minutes ago, I said, there's some percentage of Forrest Gump character in your character, in the way that you sort of smartly dumbed down the business of the Hominy Grill. So tell us a little bit how it started and then how it changed to what it is today.
I really simplified the menu and the whole operation. We're open continuously now, and that way we can service more and more people and have them all get a taste of the Low Country. And really, the things that we do well, we concentrated on that, and we left a lot of other things to other people to handle.
So this is mainstream Southern food?
Mainstream Southern food, it's more of an idea of mainstream Southern food. Southerners in the mainstream are globalized just like everywhere else, and they wouldn't look at this as mainstream. It's sometimes their ugly roots that they'd rather not know about, the heritage of the food that this area of the country ate over the last couple hundred years.
Well, they may not want to be associated with it in that respect, but they certainly come here by the hundreds, right?
They do. But they don't order the liver pudding. They don't eat that way anymore.
Oh, okay. I didn't see liver pudding on the menu.
No, that's why. I keep my personal stash handy.
But you started out as a more conventional chef, working in New York and a variety of different places. How did you come up with the idea behind Hominy Grill?
I think the idea definitely has always been inside of me, and it just I needed to have the tables and the chairs and the stove to release it. Certainly experiences in Manhattan and with different cuisines from around the world were a great help, but the techniques are a lot the same underneath, and this region had such a great influx, especially a port city like Charleston, of French Huguenots and English and Africans and Caribbean. A lot of them came through the Caribbean, so there's just so many different cultures represented it here in their food styles.
Now, you said that the idea came to you through a restaurant in New Orleans, now closed, unfortunately, called Ooglesich's.
Yes.
And you said, I know mothers in New Orleans too, and there's some similarities there.
Yes, definitely. New Orleans has a great, not only food tradition, but also a great restaurant tradition, and people, so much great food that's totally unpretentious in just how people eat every day. Those po' boys at lunch for everybody all the time. But when I get to go to New Orleans and have them, I think it's one of the most fabulous things in the world, and why can't I eat it every day?
So what's, guide us through the menu here, starting with breakfast. What are the features for breakfast?
I think our biggest asset at breakfast is the farm fresh eggs we get. We have a local farmer that brings these just beautiful eggs to us, and they're such a pleasure to work with, and they taste so great. And we just try and dress it up. Of course, grits at the Hominy Grill are important, and they come from a mill in central North Carolina, and it's an heirloom flint corn seed ground on a water wheel, and you really taste that love that and attention that has gone into making that product, and we have this fabulous bacon that is totally commercial, but you're not able to stop eating it.
that's what I had, and I have to tell you, the color of the yolks on the eggs, I haven't seen a darker color except in Spain and Italy. I've never seen a darker color here, so somebody's letting the chickens run around and get all the right things into their system.
Yeah, when you've got stuff like that to work with, you have to just do as little possible to it as necessary to present it to the diner.
Sort of get out of the way.
Yeah, it's easy. You're trying not to mess it up as your goal.
Now at 11:30, then you switch from breakfast to the same menu for the rest of the day.
Yes, yeah, and it's stocked full of Southern Low Country classics. This is a neighborhood restaurant, and our neighborhood is Charleston and in the Low Country, but also in a broader sense, all over the South. And my brother has a couple restaurants in the mountains, and we trade a lot of products and ideas with him. And as we're traditional trading partners for the port city here, would be the upstate and those areas there. So
we'll find some catfish, we'll find shrimp and grits for breakfast and also for lunch and dinner?
Yeah, shrimp and grits are a mainstay, certainly. And we have fried chicken, of course, There's dishes like shrimp creole, though, that are very southern and specific, and a curry chicken dish also that is very much a traditional Charleston dish and shows all these world influences that you know, the wealthy planters here were able to really purchase a lot of stuff on a global market during colonial period. So they imported their wines and spices and whatnot.
Now, I saw sautéed chicken livers on the menu, and I've seen those on other Charleston restaurants too. Is that another local favorite?
It seems to be. They're definitely great. They're hard to get out in restaurants and when they're done well, but it's also something that people don't fix much at home anymore. It's been, I had to look to find a supplier of livers.
But you found one, so that's great.
Yeah.
Now, the hours are a little quirky because you close at 8:30 in the evening, Monday through Friday. And then what happens on the weekend?
Well, we just do brunch on the weekend. We don't bother with Saturday night. We do a great big brunch for 6 hours on both Saturday and Sunday, and we are usually exhausted after that. And Saturday night's a good night to be home with my family. So maybe when my daughter heads off to college, I'll consider Saturday night again.
Now, this is kind of a busy. You've generated a real buzz, a real following here at Hominy Grill. What do you suggest for people who are thinking about coming here? I'm guessing you don't take reservations, so certain times of the day you might have to wait.
You do, and there's certainly a bit of skill at knowing what time to come. The off hours are best, which works out great for people who are on vacation and don't have to worry about being anywhere, so they can come in the middle of the morning or the middle of the afternoon. While we usually have a line, it moves very quickly. We're adept at moving people through. We can do 400 or 500 people on a brunch, which is doing over 100 people per hour and on less than 100 seats. So you can imagine you can get the experience pretty quick.
Now something rather interesting just happened in the life of Hominy Grill. And it was one of the things that caused On the Menu to pop by today, because we had a chance in our schedule to do that, because Chef Robert Stelling is nominated for Best Chef Southeast in the James Beard Awards. Now, that must give you a kind of a special feeling, Robert?
Yeah, just when I thought it was kind of safe to go home and take off my shoes and relax, I got nominated for a Beard Award, and I thought, oh, gosh, I got to get back in there and rethink everything and really deliver, because you know, something like this really raises people's expectation, and it's sometimes hard to deliver on those expectations on a sandwich at lunchtime.
but things aren't really going to change?
I don't think they really can. In some ways, it's its own living entity, and I'm along for the ride some days.
This is what I meant, listeners, by this Forrest Gumpishness. So I hope by now you understand where I was coming from. Let's just quickly say the location is the corner of Rutledge and Cannon Street.
Cannon, yes.
Sort of northwest of the downtown area of Charleston, but only about a mile away, so it's a short cab ride. There's a place to park as well. Is there a website, Robert, where people can get information?
We do have a website. You can just find us at hominygrill.com, and you're welcome to call the restaurant and make reservations. We do reservations at the evening, so that's a good way to get in.
Great. But the other thing you can do, which is what we did, is come to breakfast, because breakfast is fun too. Robert, thank you so much for talking to us. I'm glad we had a chance to stop by and see you.
Thank you. It was great meeting y'all.
Well, now that is a wrap, right?
That is a wrap. It was a wonderful visit to Charleston. There will be an interview upcoming with Michael, the chef and part owner of Fig. Food is good. The other restaurant that we visited, I must apologize to all our listeners and to Mike on the air also for the technical problem that we had. But the good part about it is I know we can fix it, and we'll catch up with him again real soon, and you'll have the opportunity to hear his story as well. So that's it for another week. We'll see you same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.